In today's episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, we're going to be talking about outsourcing a new user interface, questions about patents, handling incoming phone calls, and leveraging social media. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 99. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Mike?
I am encountering massive contractor woes.
Oh, no. Do tell.
So I think I had mentioned that I ended up letting one of my contractors go, right?
Yep.
That was one that kind of ended up out of the picture. And then another one, his grandmother went into the hospital. And since his mother relies a lot on him for a lot of things, he didn't drop off the face of the planet. We've talked about it a little bit. But basically, his work effort has dropped to pretty much zero because he's dealing with family issues, which I go deal with your family issues. Those are kind of more important than the other things that are going on. Another one is in the middle of applying for loans for, like a car and a couple of other things. So he's got to deal with banks and everything else. So he's really not available. Another one has just kind of dropped off the face of the planet. So it's basically left just me. It's like,
seriously. Wow. Yeah. So I've had this happen to me before where everyone, but a large number of people kind of flake or even just get caught up with other stuff all at the same time. And it's a real bummer. It seems to happen in threes.
Yeah. I think you'd mentioned before that that happened to you a couple of months ago, I think.
Yeah, it was about 6 months ago, and it was like a VA, a developer, and another developer within about 3 weeks of each other. But you know what? They were all people who had not worked for me for very long. Have these guys been around for a while, or are they recent hires?
Yeah, well, a couple of them have. I mean, one of them has been around for a long time, and then the other two have been probably a little bit more recent. So, but one of them's been really good, and then the one I let go obviously wasn't so good.
Are these contractors, do they do consulting full-time, or do they have day jobs and they're doing your work on the side?
They pretty much do this full-time.
Got it. That's surprising then, because that's like one of the questions I ask up front. I tend to want people who, are going to do it during the day and just sort of who are going to give it their first effort instead of doing it in the evenings and weekends. And I've also found that people doing it in the evenings and weekends, since it's not the primary source of income, they do tend to take it less seriously. And if they hit a rough patch, they'll just kind of bail on you. So, but it sounds like two of them are temporary and they'll be back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hey, I've been reading or listening to a book called The Facebook Effect. It's the flip side of the story that you see in the film, The Social Network. The Social Network was largely guessed at by Ben Mezrich. Ben Mezrich is kind of this author who goes after like really big, sensational stories. He wrote the Social Network as almost like a narrative, right? Where it reads like fiction, but he had to make up a bunch of the interactions just because it was a fiction book. So he has to have conversations that no one really knows what happened. And so then the movie obviously took it to the next step and just used them and dramatized them. And so the movie got a lot of criticism early on from people who were saying, yeah, it really isn't very accurate. I mean, it's kind of just a somewhat made up thing. So anyways, The Facebook Effect it's an authorized book about Facebook. And so it's going to naturally slant the other way since it's authorized because this reporter had the cooperation of Mark Zuckerberg and a bunch of other people. And so he's naturally going to be more of a fan of theirs and slant it to their benefit. But it was really interesting to hear kind of the flip side to the story about, all the lawsuits that came about because of Facebook and how many times Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook were sued, and to hear kind of his side of that story. So it's definitely not anything that you're going to listen to and it's going to help you launch a micropreneur endeavor or build a product or anything. But if someone's looking for entertainment and to get maybe a different side of the story, I definitely was fascinated by it. And I was also impressed with just some elements of, Zuckerberg's ability to dig into the social graph and frankly, his persistence in the early years of getting Facebook off the ground.
That's really cool. I mean, I watched The Social Network probably less than a month ago. There were a lot of things that went on. I just really questioned how accurate they were. I didn't realize that they would. I figured there was some embellishment, but I didn't necessarily figure out how much or, kind of look into how much. So that meant what you just said kind of makes a lot of sense that it was dramatized for, Hollywood. But, it's interesting that there's something else out there that you can kind of read the other side that it's a little bit more, I'll say, official.
Yeah. And to be honest, I mean, The Social Network is one of the few movies I've purchased in the past 5 years. And normally I just, you know, do all streaming and rental and stuff. I really like The Social Network as a film. It like motivates me. And I actually like the way the characters are portrayed. I love the dialogue. It's written by Aaron Sorkin, who's probably my favorite writer, television and film. And so I actually like the movie a lot. I mean, even Aaron Sorkin said he's never used Facebook. And it's kind of hard to write the movie about the product without at least having an idea of the product, because that's a pretty key part of the story.
Yeah, I can definitely see that.
What else is going on with you? What's the update on AutoShark?
That's a pretty disappointing story right now. I mean, between the contractor woes and the trying to rework the database that I talked about last week, there's two different sides of the database that I have to rework. It's the client-side application and then the server-side application. And to date, you know, I haven't really distributed the client-side application to anybody yet because there are basically authentication issues that I'm still dealing with. I just don't have a mechanism for people to log into it and authenticate to the server. So it's not that there's any security problem. It's just there's no security on it right now. So there's no way to synchronize things between your local database and the server, which is why I've been working on this stuff. And unfortunately, until there is that mechanism in place, I really can't publish policies out to the server easily because there's a web interface for building them, but you have to go look in the database to find the GUIDs of different things that you're looking up and different objects. And it's just not intuitive and it's really, really hard to use. I mean, the customers just definitely couldn't use it. So I would say I'm pretty far behind in terms of where I'd like to be right now. It's just going to kind of take time to plug through it. I mean, the early access customers that I've talked to and have it installed, I mean, it's up and running on their machines. It's just not really doing anything, and it's not going to be able to really do anything until I get to the point where the synchronization stuff is working and I can push those policies out to the server. And I had thought that being able to do it on the server itself through the web interface was going to be enough. And later on, it was, you know, I kind of realized that that's just not the case because you need to have the GUIDs of some of these different objects to work with, and nobody has access to them except for me because they're not surfaced through the user interface for the customers.
Right. And so, yeah, this is why you do early access, right? It's like so good to be in the hands of the customer because, you know, as of 2 weeks ago, you're like, all right, I'm pretty much done with this thing. And then they start using it. And this always happens, always, always with every project that I've launched. So it's good that they come up. If none of these come up, it's like I keep waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? If you launch it and it's like, wait a minute, there's no bugs. These people aren't using it. You know, if we haven't found like kind of a major design flaw in the first week, then I'm skeptical. Mm-hmm. So you say it's disappointing, but it's almost to be expected. You know, I guess it depends on how much time it actually takes you to fix. That could be the disappointing part. You know, if it's 40 hours of coding, that's a real bummer. It is what it is. I mean, this is certainly common stuff.
Yeah, about 40 hours is probably ballpark accurate.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be tough. So, hey, we already got suggestions for our Startups for the Rest of Us drinking game. We got them from our editor, because she has first look at all of our podcasts. She says, I'm all for a drinking game for the podcast. Drink when, and then she lists like 9 things. When Mike says, to be perfectly honest, I think that's a great one. When Rob says, shout out. When either Mike or Rob tells people to be succinct and then goes on for another minute about being succinct. When either Rob or Mike mention their kids, mention their wives, mention the weather, say the words Audit Shark, Hittail, or .NET Invoice. When Mike says, not a whole heck of a lot, when either says, that about wraps us up. So the awesome suggestions, and as Mike said last week, if you have any other suggestions we should incorporate into the Startups for the Rest of Us drinking game, please do send them over.
Have you noticed that I did not say, to be perfectly honest, or not a whole heck of a lot?
So I know. I know you didn't. I guess that about wraps us up for that segment. Oh, nailed it. Hey, well, I want to give a shout out to Aaron. How else do you say that?
I don't know. Heads up. I have no idea. I don't know what you'd say.
Well, we want to extend some special thanks to Eric Foster from Portland, Oregon. He left a very complimentary call on our voicemail line. It was just kind of, you know, thanking us for the podcast, telling him the things he liked. And yeah, we really appreciate hearing from you. Even if you don't want us to publish it on the podcast, it's just meant for us. It still is great to hear people's voice. And maybe it's more convenient too if you listen in the car just to dial up the number at the end. And that was really cool. Thanks, Eric.
You know, I forgot to mention on last week's episode that I'm headed to the Business of Software conference, and that's a little unfortunate because by the time this episode goes live, people will already be at the conference and they won't hear me say, hey, if you're there, get in touch with me.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah, it would have been nice to have it last week. So BOS next week. Very cool. Well, I'm not going this year, so I hope to have a full report in the following episode, which I think will be 101. Episode 100, listeners, keep your eye out for it. We have some special guests coming on to assist us with that.
I've been catching up on a lot of my podcasts while I've been traveling lately, and I listened to a episode of Texting earlier this week, and I was extremely disappointed. It was the wives episode where
episode
your wife...
200.
Yes.
Yep.
And it wasn't the episode itself that was disappointing. I mean, I thought the episode itself was actually quite outstanding, but what I'm disappointed about is that you don't bring out your feminine side on this podcast.
Oh my gosh. There was Yeah, if you haven't heard that, listen to that. And let's see, she also said I like Project Runway, right?
I thought it was The Bachelorette.
No, that's Jason Roberts.
Oh, I must have been confused.
Because I gave him crap about liking The Bachelorette in comments, and he said, hey, she said you like Project Runway, so you're not one to talk. Yeah, well, Mike, maybe
I was listening to that episode, and I'm just thinking to myself, I am so glad my wife didn't go on that episode.
About it. And we, you know, I got no editing say over what was said, and actually Jason and Justin didn't either. Let's dive into the listener questions.
So the first one comes in from Jeff Noble, and he says, first off, love your show. It's really the very best podcast in the micropreneur vertical. I think it's the only podcast in the micropreneur vertical, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
So yes, naturally we're the best, but we're also the worst. So he says, I can't tell you how much I learned driving back and forth to a job I hope to eventually not drive back and forth to. I started working on a project over a year ago, and I've been working alone until about 2 months ago when I asked a friend to join me. I'm a senior software engineer, and my friend is a great asset on the business side. I'm concurrently dealing with two issues, so naturally I have two questions. The first is, I currently have a site I paid a contractor for very early in the project, but it just doesn't work anymore. I have way too much content, and the old design doesn't give me a place to put it. I'm not a web designer, and I know my limitations. If I go with a contractor via Odesk, what's the best way to work with them? Do I send screenshots of what I have and scribbles of what I'm looking for? Do I give remote access somehow? And if so, how do I protect my code? How can I make sure that the HTML they provide will cut up well with master pages and is developer ready? And there's a few other related questions here, but I think there's some basics of working with contractors via Odesk to get web pages built. And Rob, you've done this a lot as well as I have, so why don't you kind of give your feedback first?
Sure. So it sounds like he hired someone to build a site for him, and the site is breaking. Like the layout comes apart when he adds dynamic content or something. And so, frankly, the first contractor didn't do a very good job, is what it sounds like to me, because this should not happen. So my thoughts, if I had a site that did this and I felt like the first contractor was easy to work with and was good, the original person who built this, then I would frankly go back to him and let him know that, you know, what's gone on and that the site actually isn't working, and figure out if you guys can work something out. This, again, assuming that he was reasonable, easy to work with, and you had a decent relationship. And maybe you don't pay full rate for that stuff. Maybe you pay, you know, a discounted rate, or he does some stuff for free or something. Because realistically, just throwing up a site that doesn't actually fully work, you know, when I was working for people, you didn't do that. I guaranteed my work. Second thing, if that doesn't work out, I would look on Odesk. I've found several good CSS and HTML and designers on Odesk. If I was in your situation, I would find someone who looked reasonable, hire them, and I would probably start, yes, I would give them access to the server. You asked, do I give remote access or how do I protect my code? If you have a bunch of custom code with a custom database, maybe you need to think about that. But if really it's just HTML pages, the odds of someone stealing your HTML pages is just very small. So obviously depends on your risk tolerance, but I mean, I've worked with 15 or 20 contractors in the past 5 to 7 years, and almost unequivocally, especially if the site's not live, yes, I give remote access, because the more of a barrier and bottleneck you are trying to manually shuffle pages back and forth or something, the less that's going to get done and the more frustrated both he, you know, the contractor, and you're going to be. So in terms of sending screenshots or what you're looking for, I tend to record a screencast if I think that that's going to be helpful, you know, if I can talk through what I want. If I need something more, you know, written, then yeah, I would consider either marking things up in like a paint program, like paint.net or Photoshop, you know, taking a screenshot of your current situation and then marking it up. Or I would even print them out. This is going to sound so arcane, but I would print them out and I would handwrite comments on them. I've done that before. I find it a lot faster, and I'm a lot better at that than using a paint program, and then scan them back in and send them as a as a SPAC. I don't know that you need much more than that. It really does depend on your changes, of course. But that's how I would begin to approach it. And yeah, it depends a lot on your success with this project. Depends a lot on how good the contractor is that you find. And so, you know, that's the key here. And we've talked a lot about how to do that in the past.
I've gone through some of this recently, and what I ended up doing was I actually hired two people, and it sounds like Jeff is in a position where he has a full-time job, so he's already spending time in the car and at work every day, and that's cutting into his time. So because this type of stuff is not necessarily core to your product, I mean, it's important to make your product look good because that's what helps to sell the product, but I feel like these are the types of things that you should definitely outsource completely. I mean, you shouldn't be spending your time taking the designer stuff and putting it into the program. What you really should be doing is, and this is kind of what I did, was I actually hired two people. I hired somebody who was just a designer, and then I had him hand his stuff off to a developer who put it into a Visual Studio project and created all the master pages and the basic layouts of everything. And then as I integrated that stuff into my code, into my source code for the actual application, then if there were problems with anything, I would send them back and just kind of go through that process again. And I put those two contractors directly in touch with each other. I said, if one of you has questions, go to the other, talk to each other, log the time, I'll pay you guys for it, that's fine, and then just walk through that process. In terms of access to my server, I did not give them access to my server. What I did was I set up an automated build system where when they were working on things, it would automatically deploy it into a development area that would go live, but they didn't have direct access to the server. So if anything in that deployment broke, it was up to them to essentially push code back into Mercurial, the source code repository, and then the build would automatically kick off shortly, and then it would deploy it to the web server, and then they could see those changes live on the server. So that's kind of how I dealt with most of those things. But I think that making something look good is something that you definitely want to outsource to the contractors that are going to do that, because it's not to say that it's a waste of time, but it's just not the best use of your time.
Right. And I think in terms of accessing the server, I think he's concerned because he has existing code. It looks like he might have some custom code that's been written. And, you know, he asks, how do I protect my code? I mean, to be honest, there is no way to protect your code if you're going to, I mean, you can go try to give people access only to a single directory if you think, you know, that's, but it's never been worth my time to do that. Because what are they going to do? They're going to take your code and do what? Sell it on the black market? Like, no one wants it. And if they try to compete with you, you need to be able to outmarket them. There's going to be competition anyways. So
yeah, I wasn't worried about that so much as I was about them having access to like the other products that I have on my server and production data from other products.
So that's totally different. Yep, yeah. I agree. He has a non-production site, and he just has a, you know, I'm assuming he has just custom code for this app, that this web app he has. No, for you, I agree. I don't, if I have a like a production like the Hittail server, I don't give contractors access to that, but I have a Subversion repository that has the code in it. And when I get a new contractor, I do just a simple 4-hour project. And if we communicate well and I trust him, he gets access to the whole thing. And he could feasibly pull the Hittail code base down to his box. And, you know, at this point, what is he going to do with that? You know, that's the question I have for you. What is the risk? So I'm not saying there's no risk, but for me, if I'm going to have people working on my stuff, they need to have access to it.
Yeah, and I think to kind of get around the server side access as well, I mean, you could, if it's a Linux box, I mean, there's tons of places where you could just stand up a Linux server for a really cheap price for, you know, a month or 2 months or however long it takes for this project to go. If it's Windows, it's probably going to be more expensive. But again, if you have somebody working 10, 15, 20 hours a week, and, you know, you start weighing the cost of them for, let's say, the 10 hours a week, that's $100 a week. You've got $400 a month there. What's a Windows server going to cost you for a month? $50, $60? It doesn't seem to me like setting up a staging server for them to use that they have full administrative access to is a big deal.
And then I think the last question of this part, he asks about, you know, I purchased templates long ago. They look great till I put dynamic content in them, and then the whole layout came apart. How do I manage that with Odesk? And I think the bottom line is you need to find a good designer / HTML CSS person and think about it as an ongoing relationship. So don't think, oh, here's this 2-week gig, go do this, and then you leave and you move on, and then you're stuck without someone to maintain it. This stuff always requires maintenance. All the designers I work with who do design or CSS work for me, I'm pinging them once a month for little changes or tweaks or fixes, browser issues. There's always new stuff. There's maintenance that comes up. So don't think about this as a single project. Think about it as an ongoing thing. It'll have an upfront stack of hours, but then beyond that, try to build a relationship with this person that you are going to be working with them ongoing a few hours a month. That's a great part about Odesk, is that it's fairly easy to do that. You just ping them with a task, and then you only get billed for what they work on. So that is one of the big benefits, and I think keeping that mindset in place helps you get this set up from the start.
And what you just mentioned there is extremely important in terms of browser compatibility, because there's been all kinds of things that I've run into where I'll see something or somebody will say something, say, hey, this doesn't work in my browser. And I say, well, what are you using? Oh, I'm using IE9. Okay, well, I just send it over to the verify it and then just send it over to the designer and say, hey, this piece isn't working in IE9. What can you do? And he just sends me a new set of CSS files. I just add them back to the site and I'm done. So Jeff's follow-up question to that is, my project relies on data from users. It's a site that shares information from one user to another. I suppose forums may have some of the same issue, but in your opinion, what is the best way to populate the site when it's new? My biggest fear is that people will find the site once it's launched, see it's basically empty, and then bounce goes the graph. One idea I had was to populate the site's content locally myself and focus on marketing locally only in the beginning, but I worry that the overall product will suffer in markets that I have not put effort into yet. The web's a big place.
Now, you talked a little more with him, right? And did you get an idea more of what he's talking about, some specifics?
I did. The best example that he gave me was something called GasBuddy, because he didn't want to share exactly what his product was or product idea was. So the best example that he gave was GasBuddy, where, if you're not familiar with GasBuddy, it's essentially an application where you go in and you can find the cheapest gas prices in your area. And what that really relies on is people in, who live around the country seeing these prices, entering them, and helping to keep the information up to date. So let's say that you lived in an area of the country where nobody was using it. If you're the only one using it, then you've got no data to go off of, and you're left with this chicken and egg problem where you're reliant upon the users to provide data, but until they start providing that data, you've got nothing to share with people. So it's definitely a chicken and egg problem.
Yeah, if I was going after something like this, similar to GasBuddy, first you do have to have it populated, right? You're exactly right. If people come and there's nothing there, they're going to bounce. So a couple approaches that come to mind is, the first thing, you need to have some type of motivation for people to take that, even if it's 5 or 10 seconds. You need to have motivation for them to do that. So gamification is a buzzword these days. It holds some value to have like a leaderboard of like, these people are the leaders in these cities or these geographic areas, whatever you divide them up to be. And people can, compete against each other, and they get a badge on the site if they've done the most updates. Kind of like being a mayor in Foursquare. And Stack Overflow is the other great example, right? They really focused on offering some type of benefit, even if it wasn't monetary. It was just prestige. It was just being good at something and being publicly recognized. So that's an idea of how to get people motivated. Now, I think initially, that doesn't mean anything if there's no one on the site. So you're going to have to do, a couple ideas come to mind. One is to go to Craigslist in each of the, maybe go after the top 10 metro areas. Depends on how much time you have to do this. But you can do the top 10 metro areas or top 20 metro areas. Assuming you're in the US, you can find that list and then go to those Craigslist and post and ask people to do this. And initially, you very well may have to pay them. You have to figure out a price point that works for you, but you have to get that data in there. And since it does rely on your geography, you can't just go. Typically, I would say, if you just had a forum, I would go and hire some people. If it was a forum for designers, I would go to Odesk. I would hire 5 or 10 designers, and I would get some discussion started, and I would ask them to participate. Or if I had an audience of designers, actually, a good example is the Micropreneur Academy. There are forums in there, and before anyone got in there, I didn't want dead forums before I launched it. And so I had 5 charter members who were people I'd been emailing with, and I let them in early, and we had a bunch of discussions so that the forums were reasonably populated when folks got in, and they were like, oh, people are already posting. So if you have an audience that can do this, that all the better. But my guess is, you wouldn't be asking this if you had an audience. So I do think initially you're going to have to hire to do that. Now, if there's other sources of data that you could either buy or scrape to kind of get the thing populated initially, that would be another idea if you could do that online. And this is a really hard app to launch because it has a true two-sided market. that you're trying to get people to post data and take time to do that. Most people don't want to do that. And then you're also going to have to try to attract people to come and consume the data, right? Because you're going to presumably have ads or affiliate links or some way to make money from this. And that's a lot. It's a lot of work. You know, without experience doing this before, it's going to be tough to get it off the ground well and to get both sides of the market coming at the same time. And it's also going to be hard to do part-time without some help. So you definitely, I think you're going to need some budget to get people on there helping you.
The other thing that comes to mind is if you're building a mailing list, you could ask them to fill out a profile beforehand. And essentially, you know, as part of that mailing list, maybe you have 1,000 or 2,000 people on there. And you ask everyone to fill out a profile. And of the people who do fill out a profile, then what you could do is you can take that information and concentrate on different clusters of people and populate data explicitly related to where they are in the country or their interest or however your application actually works. And then from there, just invite those people to kind of start with. And then once they get in there, they're using it. The people who come in after them are not going to see kind of a blank slate unless all the data is truly localized. If you're just relying on a specific group of people providing information that another group of people are going to use, then you're going to have to start somewhere.
Yeah, and I guess that's the other approach you could take is truly just doing one local area and doing it in the one where you live because you have real feet on the ground and you have probably friends, acquaintances in the area who could also help out. And so just to test the idea and to see if it's viable at all, you may want to start with that and truly start small with it. And then once you've planned that out and figured out how much traffic you can get for that area, then you can say, well, is this worth scaling out to the top 20 cities in the US or is the idea not, you know, does it not work? Kind of as an afterthought, I think that may be what I do, unless the idea specifically doesn't allow for that.
So Jeff, thanks for the call. Hopefully that helps you out. So our next question comes from Joshua Harmon, and he left us a voicemail. Joshua also emailed us about a week later and gave us some additional information. So here's the voicemail that he left us.
Hi, Mike and Rob. My name is Josh, and I'm looking at starting up my own business, working with some friends and getting it off the ground. In episode 75, a listener had brought up a question about patenting and if it was important. I was looking at doing that myself. And then in the search, ended up finding out that said patent was already filed. Of course, at this point, that's making me a little bit wary because I've built my entire business idea kind of based around one of the processes that it sounds like it might be on. Is there any suggestions that you have if it looks like an idea that, you know, once was novel, now is, you know, potentially patented by someone else and might get you in a little trouble? I'd love to hear what you guys think. Thanks for the show. It has been a great help for someone like me who's looking to start up his first software-based business. So thank you very much and have a good day.
I don't know. This is kind of an interesting problem with patents. I mean, patents, I've never applied for a patent. And I think that you had said at one point that Hittail had a patent application in progress or something.
That's right.
Along those lines.
It did. Yep.
Was it even worth pursuing, though?
Not really. I let the patent app expire.
But I think that having a patent versus what he's referring to is somebody else has a patent on something and he's wondering what he should be concerned about. You know, are there ways around it? Should he try to buy the patent? You know, I think there's a lot of issues here that, you know, need to be dealt with. So I think you and I are probably both in agreement on our stance and feeling on patents. I mean, software patents especially are just ridiculous. I mean, there's no way that 95% of these software patents should even be allowed in any way, shape, or form. Unfortunately, because the patent office really just has no clue when it comes to software, they look at it as if it was a physical product, and they just really don't know what they're doing, so they're basically just rubber stamping a lot of these things without really looking at them in depth. And what you end up with is patents that have been approved for things like one-click ordering systems. And sure, Amazon has that and allows you to just order something with one click, but big deal. I mean, that's not exactly a novel concept. And so I think that there's a lot of these patents out there that are just garbage patents, but unfortunately, as a micropreneur, you may need to not only be aware of them, but be aware of the risks that you may be getting sued over something that you've invented. So I think that for this particular one, though, I would be hesitant to give specific advice about whether or not you should, you know, try to buy this patent or try to fight it or just ignore it. That's something that I think that you really need to talk to an IP lawyer about and find out from him, you know, what are the risks associated with it? is your idea realistically overlapping enough to the point that you stand a good chance of being sued, or are those risks minimal? And then judging from your own risk tolerances, figure out whether or not you're willing to accept those risks and do it anyway, or are they high enough that you want to make an attempt to buy the patent or just walk away from the idea and go for something else?
Yeah, this really depends on your risk tolerance. Like Mike said, we just can't give specific advice about something like this because there's just liability involved. Let me say that I don't know of an app that you could build these days that does not break some type of patent or infringe on some type of patent, because some of the patents, a lot of the software patents that have been granted since 1998 when they became, you know, legalized, I'll say, before that you couldn't patent software. You could copyright it, but you couldn't patent any elements of it. And I have to be honest, I am a heavy, heavy opponent of software patents because they've gotten so out of control, because they're so highly technical, and because the Patent and Trademark Office has allowed these obvious, a lot of obvious patents to get through. And some of them are so broad, there's no way that you can build an app without violating them. So I bet every app that I own violates multiple patents if you actually went and dug, because there things are patented, like sending data back and forth between a mobile device and a server. You know, things like displaying search results in a table that's sortable by clicking links at the top. Well, if you have any type of application that displays search results, that's how we display them, and that's how we've always done it. You put it in a grid, and everyone knows you click the top to sort. And so, yes, could I be sued tomorrow? Absolutely. Almost anyone could. And in fact, once you hit a certain size, your chances of being sued are very high because of all the patent issues that, you know, the patent trolls and such that are floating around. So that's my general thought on this situation. It needs to be fixed, and there's, you know, it's going to be so hard to do so because there's these patent trolls that are lobbying Congress and trying to keep this stuff in place. And the law today does say if you have this patent that is really hard to overturn. So, you know, I think a couple things to think about are if you do something and it never takes off, then yeah, your odds of being sued are probably pretty low. If you do something and it grows to 5 or 10,000 a month, your odds of being sued are probably pretty low just because you're not really, you know, on anyone's radar. You know, and as you grow bigger, then yeah, the odds of you being sued, period, for any of these patents, not just, you know, the one that Josh was pointing out, they absolutely go up. So again, it comes down to risk tolerance.
Our next question comes from Matt White, and he says, Rob, I know you're a busy man, so I'll try to keep this brief. I've read your book, loved it, and started a small shuttle business with some friends. We decided early on that we wanted a phone number on our website, WenatcheeValleyShuttle.com, so that people would feel like they could trust us and call to make sure we were real. The problem is that we get a lot more calls than we expected, and a lot of these people want to book our shuttle over the phone. We usually just do the booking for them, but it's very disruptive to our day. It's not enough calls to justify hiring someone, and I'm not aware of any call center that would want a contract that only sends them 15 to 20 calls a day. We would really like to get as many of these people as possible to book on the site instead. We could take down the number, but we're afraid we'll lose a significant number of sales that way. We could charge an additional fee for booking over the phone, but that only solves the problem halfway because it doesn't reduce call volume, just call duration. Any suggestions or ideas? Thanks for everything, Matt White. So I think that, you know, this is one of those things where you could actually turn to a software solution for it. And if memory serves me correctly, if you signed up for a Twilio account, you could probably build essentially a call center software solution that would do exactly this for you and could walk people through the essentially booking your shuttles for them.
Nice, like an IVR system, interactive voice response, where it's like push one to book now, and then they
exactly
enter some numbers for a date or whatever.
Exactly. The other thing that I can think of is that if you check with grasshopper.com, they do small business phone systems, and they may very well have something that's similar to this that would just be out of the box that you wouldn't have to build yourself. Twilio provides a lot of developer APIs that would make it possible for you to build this type of thing, but Grasshopper may very well have something that is, you know, already pre-built that you just do some customizations to it, and that may be enough. It kind of depends on how much time and effort you want to put into this and you know, how much I guess pain you're willing to go through of doing the development yourself or outsourcing it, I guess.
Yeah, I have two thoughts on this. The first is to test and to not pick up the phone for 1 week and to leave a voicemail message that tells people that they should book online, that you no longer or you're currently not accepting reservations over the phone. and see what happens. See, you know, watch the volume, and you maybe you need to do a 2-week test, but maybe you'll know after one day if, you know, if suddenly your bookings plummet, then you know to undo it. But I would test to see what kind of impact that has, because if you're, you know, if these calls really are impacting your ability to work, then it may be worth your while to lose a few reservations. The other thought I had is that I'm sure you know your net profit margin per booking. And so if you make, let's say, $5 per booking, which I imagine is low, and you're getting 15 phone bookings a day, then you can, you know, spend, you know, up to $75 and not lose money. So obviously you want to spend less than that, but that does justify potentially hiring someone to just to handle the calls. And what I would think about doing, the way I would handle it, is I would go to Odesk, I would find someone who takes inbound phone calls, I would post the project, and I would say, this is, you know, inbound call answering and reservation taking on an as-needed basis. And I can almost guarantee you there are people on Odesk who do this. And I don't know, to be honest, how they bill. If they bill per incoming call, that would probably be my guess, is they will charge you per call. And they just have to be around to answer for these 8 or 10 hours of the day, or whatever you specify. So that way, if you do make $5 or $10 per call and you're paying them two, then it you know, easily scales up and down, and you're not paying someone just to sit around. So if you find someone, I would tend to look in the US if you're in the US, because you want the same time zones, and get them a Skype number that dials over to them, or use Grasshopper like Mike said. But I actually don't think this is a very hard problem to solve.
So Matt, thanks a lot for your question. I hope that the answers that we gave you will help kind of push you in the right direction. So this one comes from Mark, and he says, "Hi guys, what's up? First of all, I have to say I love the podcast. Not only does it provide me with actionable advice, it has also broadened my understanding of what a startup can be. The industry leads us to believe we have to aim extremely high, work crazy hours, and take huge risks. But personally, that doesn't sound too interesting to me. I really enjoy work, but I don't want to be enslaved by it. My question is with regards to leveraging your company's Twitter and Facebook accounts to increase brand awareness, drive traffic to your site, etc. How often should you post updates? Share too much and people might unsubscribe. Share too little and you're wasting opportunities. To give you a little bit more background info on my particular case, I run a site called BetaList that covers pre-launch startups. We currently post about 3 posts a day, and apart from the site itself, RSS, and a daily newsletter, we also share these posts via Twitter to 9,000 followers and 700 Facebook fans. So that's about 3 posts per day. I've been thinking about sharing relevant links, podcasts, videos, popular posts on the site, etc., but I'm hesitant actually doing this as I'm not sure that's what people subscribe for, and I'm afraid it might hurt my company's reputation. I've asked people and the response was mixed. What's your experience? Am I worrying too much? Looking forward to your response, Mark."
So my thought on this one is, especially with Twitter and Facebook, it's kind of a stream of consciousness medium anyways, that when I subscribe to someone on Twitter, if they start posting more or they start posting something I didn't exactly sign up for, I don't even think most people are going to notice, to be honest. I think the only time you might run into unsubscribes is the email newsletter, right? If someone signed up for a specific thing, even RSS, it's just people just take it as long as it's in the genre and you're giving valuable stuff. Like you said, you're going to be aggregating links, filtering, sharing podcasts, videos, popular posts. Like that stuff tends to be helpful. And so I would bet that you will not see many people unsubscribe. Via the email newsletter, I would just take the plunge and test it and put it in. I mean, you're going to need to just try it out. 3 posts per day, I'm assuming you mean to Twitter and Facebook. That doesn't sound like very much to me at all for an active kind of newsletter that covers a lot of startups. I mean, you really have a lot of content to share. I don't feel like ramping that up would be a big deal. So if I were in your shoes, I would probably just ramp it up and see what happens. And yeah, you may get a few people that unsubscribe, but my guess is you may also take on new subscribers because you're putting out, as long as it's quality, valuable stuff. And my guess is you might even grow a tighter, more engaged audience, especially if you can give them just better information than they're getting elsewhere.
Yeah, I would agree with Rob. The only comment that I would make is that if you're looking to do this on your email newsletter, I don't know as I would send out 3 emails a day. I would probably send one that includes a bunch of information in it with links back to your site. And part of that is so that you can get those people back to your site to drive traffic for other things, because people generally read their emails. I think it's one of the few mediums that really, really works well these days. Everyone screams and raves about Facebook and Twitter and how many followers they have for this or that. But the reality is that most people don't buy things through Twitter or Facebook, but they, you know, they read their email pretty intently because, and I think Patrick McKenzie pointed this out in one of his blog posts, but one of the things that you'll notice with email is that people treat their email as generally pretty important. So when your emails appear next to other things that are important, they're going to treat that as being more important to them. And I think that's a good distinction to have. But obviously, you don't want to abuse it when it comes to email because people do read it more. They do treat it with, I'll say, a little bit more care when they're looking at their email. So definitely make sure you scale back on the posts per day for the email. But for the other ones, I would agree with Rob. Just start blasting them out there and kind of see what happens. And if things really do tank, you'll probably be able to measure that pretty quickly with 9,000 people. And scale that back as needed. But again, there's so much stuff going through people's Twitter streams that they don't even see 90% of it. So even if you post three times a day, the only people that you're probably going to turn off are the people who are on Twitter all day. And chances are that that's just a drop in the bucket for everyone else. So Mark, thanks again for your question. Our next question comes in from another Mark Snyder. And Mark says, "Hey guys, I have a question. Do you typically work on multiple endeavors at once, or do you try to keep things focused and stick with one idea at a time? Love the show and keep up the good work. Mark from Milwaukee."
So Mike is someone who is doing AltairsTraining.com, Forum Software, Audit Shark. Anything else?
I don't think so. I think that's it. Well, I think it's hard. I don't know as I would recommend it, to be perfectly honest. I think most of mine are kind of in different stages. It's starting to come to a head, I guess. But I think there's a distinction to be made between running multiple startups versus having different small products. And I think you can attest to that as well. And the other distinction I would probably make is that there's a difference between running them and starting them. Because if you're trying to start multiple side businesses at the same time, it's really hard to do that. But just getting one to a point where it's maintainable and then starting a different one and then getting that to a point where it's maintainable is a kind of a completely different story.
Yeah, I've always been pretty hard-lined about this, that I never try to build and launch two at the same time. I never try to revamp two at the same time because it takes so much focus and commitment and all that. And it's like you said, if you get it to the point where it is kind of in maintenance mode, it can still be growing, but it doesn't require all that upfront work to get the processes in place, get the marketing going, all that stuff. Once that's done, it really does, the workload really does reduce quite a bit. And it's much more easier to automate or outsource large chunks of it. I would absolutely not recommend trying to, build and grow two endeavors at once, but building one for a time and then putting it in maintenance and doing another, and then even coming back to that first one at a later date, once the second one's in maintenance mode, I actually do that quite often. So Mike, do you feel like with your Forum Software and Altair's Training and Audit Shark that's been like a detriment having too many things going on?
I think that for the things that, like for the Forum Software and the Altair's Training website, I don't pay nearly as much attention to them as I probably could. So because I'm not paying attention to them and it's still, I would say, early on, especially for the Altair's Training site, I could probably squeeze more money out of it. I could probably optimize a lot more things, but I'm not paying attention to it nearly as much. So that's just not happening. And then for the Forum Software, that's kind of in a rebuild mode where I've had a developer who's been working on it, and I've been making high level decisions and just kind of handing them off and saying, here, go do this. But because it really hasn't gotten to the point until the past week or so where things I need to start paying attention to it, it hasn't really been an issue. If I were trying to build all of them or trying to grow all of them at once, I think it'd be really hard just because of the level of effort that the marketing side takes. I don't like to put it this way, but marketing is kind of a time sink. It could take you much longer amount of time to get to where you want, and it's very, very difficult to estimate. I would probably say it's just as difficult to estimate how much time it's going to take you to complete something from a marketing perspective as it is a very complicated programming problem, because you don't necessarily know when the end is. You can't just say, oh, well, I'm going to do search engine optimization and it will take me about 6 hours. Well, chances are good that it's going to take you a lot more than 6 hours. It could take you significantly longer, and the problem is you don't necessarily know when you're done. And then coupled with that, it takes you a lot of time to see what your results are. So it's not like programming where there's a defined endpoint for that sort of thing, but it may just be complicated to estimate. When you're doing marketing, it may take you 2 or 3 hours of work, and then you wait a week to figure out, okay, well, did that have any effect? And then you have to measure it. So I think that those are two slightly different things, and the marketing side is just much more difficult to estimate because there's no hard ending to it. You just kind of have to make a judgment call and say, I am done working on this because I have chosen to be done. So Mark, thanks for sending in that question. Hopefully that helps you out. Rob, do we have anything else?
That wraps us up for today.
I think that's a drink too. If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsforrestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.